This is a CBC podcast.
Hello, hello. Okay, great.
From the Canadian
Broadcasting Corporation.
This
is Spark.
This is Spark.
Technology.
Trends.
And fresh.
Fresh ideas.
Fresh ideas.
This
is on the air.
This is
online.
This is Spark.
CBC.ca/Spark.
I'm Nora Young, and this is Spark. This time, tracking the life cycle of products, from the latest new trend in design to finding the best customer service agent, you. But first, when a gadget takes its last gasp. So I'm in the kitchen, washing the dishes and talking on my cell phone. And I reach for my dirty Star Trek thermos and... I drop my cell phone in the sink! I put my hand in and fish it out as soon as I can. Phew. Then I go into the washroom, and I put my purse on the back of the toilet. And what do you know? Finally, with the help of a plunger, I'm able to fish it out. Then I walk out into the street, and it's pouring out. While I'm trying to hail a cab to take to my swimming class, I get splashed by a passing car. By the time I finally get to the pool, I'm soaking wet, and as I make my way across the deck to the change room, I trip on a pile of water wings. And I fall into the pool, cell phone and all. What a coinkydink, all that happening in one morning. Now, I know it sounds ridiculous, but 855,000 cell phones are dropped in toilets in the UK every year. For some reason, StatsCan has not gotten around to getting the statistics on that.
So I came home late one night and I threw my jacket in the washer and it had my cell phone in it.
The cell phone fell out of my shirt pocket into the drink.
Right into the water.
And it started to rain and my cell phone was soaked.
Eventually it did work, but I felt like a big idiot.
So what do you do when your cell phone is soaking wet anyway? Liz?
Nora, I just read this on the internet. And it must be true, right?
Because it's on the internet.
Exactly. You put your wet phone in dry rice.
In dry rice, so not cooked rice.
Not cooked rice. Right. Dry rice in a Tupperware container, put it in there, and the rice is supposed to draw out the moisture.
Really?
Really?
All right.
Want to try?
Sure. Anything's worth a try. Cell phone, dry rice. I'll give it a shot. Just hold on to that thought. In our disposable culture of upgrades and hype over the latest bright, shiny gadget, what does it take to get a product that looks great when you get it, ages well, and doesn't become just another throwaway piece of junk? Well, it concerns all parts of the product cycle, from the first designs to the end of the line. The life of a product starts with its design, and where better to look for inspiration than the London Design Festival that just wrapped up? It showcases some of the latest trends in industrial design, and one of the most provocative shows was a thing called Trash Lux. It featured young designers who make high-end, lovely, and sometimes kind of weird furniture and design out of unwanted, discarded materials, the remains of the previous product cycle that are usually thrown away.
I go trawling, as I call it. Which is I'm known by all the second-hand furniture shops in Portsmouth where I live, and I literally go to jumble sales, sometimes on the streets. I mean, you know, my friends are saying, you know, please don't you dare go and pick up that chair over the other side of the road when I'm with them.
Karen Ryan is an artist and a designer who makes furniture and dishware out of the discarded objects most people leave at the curb. Hi, Karen.
Hi.
Can you describe what we see when of your work when we go into the Trash Lux show?
There's a number of pieces there. One of the major pieces is the table. And then with that are two custom-made chairs. I think there's three pieces of chairs in each chair. They play with each other. You have a Victorian chair with a 1970s chair with, you know, kind of almost like a kitchen chair that reminds me of my grand's 1950s kitchen chair. So they kind of play with their own narratives between each other.
I mean, there's no shortage of discarded furniture or plates. How do you decide what to use? What makes something speak to you?
I work very much as an artist. It is an emotional response. I mean, some things people think, my God, you know, that is so ugly. Why do you are you picking it up? You know, and I can't explain it sometimes.
Hmm. What do you like about working this way?
I think it's very honest. I think it's a very honest way of working. We're quite gluttonous in our turnaround of what we believe to be an object and how long we consider to have an object for. And I really like the idea that they're all one-off, you know, that we value the process of remaking, if you like. rather than just, you know, throwing something else and going and getting another packet of disposable razors. I find it very peculiar, you know, it's as though we're becoming soulless.
The work that you and other designers in the show, the Trash Luxe show, make this sort of salvage design, where do you think this movement comes from? Why is this touching a chord now?
I think it's because it's become very prevalent now, hasn't it? The, you know, landfill and all of that is becoming a very hot issue. So I think that obviously people are very keen to see that to go over into both design and fashion. So that's where possibly the heat of the movement is coming at the moment. But I'm not an eco-designer. I'm not. I have politics about the process of my work and particular personal beliefs about the reasons why I do my work. But I've held them for many years. I think it's very easy to say, I'm an eco-designer. Look, I've got some things that people have thrown out and here's something. But will they then change what they do next year to what the fashion is next year?
And if I have any good garage sale furniture that I think you might use, I should give you a call back.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
If you'd like to get a look at some homegrown combinations of high style and throwaway materials, Vancouver design company Contexture makes these great retro holders for iPods. For the Nano, it sits in an old hollowed-out tape cassette, and for the regular iPod, they shape
old 45 RPM singles into stylish cases because it turns out the hole in the center of the 45 is the same size as the iPod click wheel.
Genius! Find a link at our blog to take a look.
From the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, you're listening to Spark, Tech, Trends, and Fresh Ideas.
cbc.ca/spark.
Okay, Liz, I got the rice to dry out the cell phone.
That looks like fancy rice, Nora.
It's sushi rice. The Japanese food store was the nearest place open. So here's the thing. I'm in the store looking at all the cool stuff, walking down the aisle, past there's the miso there, those little pocky things, the soba noodles, and I see this rack of magazines for Japanese teenagers. And I flip over one of them, and I see this, stamped on the back cover where the barcode should be.
What is that thing? It looks like a little tiny crossword puzzle.
Aha! It's something called a QR code.
QR codes are a way to hyperlink the physical world with the digital world.
And it turns out they're huge in Japan. It's like the next generation of barcodes. So you take a picture of the QR code with your cell phone camera, and since so many cameras in Japan will also let you connect to the internet, the QR code takes you to the website for the product that the QR code is stuck on.
Hang on a second. So if I take a picture of that little square with my phone, it will take me to the website for the magazine.
Exactly.
Cool.
Mm-hmm.
My name's Michael Kiefrel, and I work for Sea Scout Japan, which is an international trend consultancy.
Michael, for somebody who's never seen one, what does one of these QR codes look like?
When you look at it from far away, it just looks like a square with lots of little black squares inside. So, yeah, it looks just like a crossword puzzle.
So if I visited you in Japan, where would I see QR codes?
Hot, everywhere these days. In the last 2 years, they've really exploded. They've been integrating the QR code readers into the phones for some time now. But now that people are starting to learn what they can really do with them, they've exploded. You can see them in advertisements, on products themselves. Even when you go buy a Big Mac at McDonald's, there's a QR code on the wrapper that you can scan. Advertisements just on the walls where they'll have a normal advertisement, but at the bottom there'll be a QR code that if you're interested in learning more about the product or the service, you just pull out your Keitai, you pull out your cell phone and turn on the scanner and scan it. It goes directly to a mobile site.
What kind of information am I then getting when I go to the website?
Well, it really just depends on what you scan. For example, the TV guide in Japan, which is called I think TV Japan, actually. Inside of the pages, there are QR codes for each section. So you could scan the QR code for that section, which would bring up your TV schedule for that day.
Right. So why do you think they're practically ubiquitous in Japan, but we've never seen them at all in North America, as far as I know?
Well, the way technology goes here is that when something's adopted, it's pretty much adopted across the board. I mean, people kind of go with the flow here, and everything seems to mix really well. I mean, this is a very mobile society. Everything communication revolves around the mobile, whereas in the West, digital communication revolves around the PC. Basically, Japanese had their first experience with kind of this web of information from their mobiles and through mobile sites. Whereas in the West, everyone started on their computers and are moving towards mobiles. In mm-hmm. Japan, it's the exact opposite. People are just now getting into PC applications and things like that. Most people, to be honest, don't know a lot about computers here. Not as much as you'd think they would.
Totally fascinating, Michael. Thank you.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you.
What a great way to learn about stuff before you buy it. Maybe even what to do if it gets wet.
Sandy McAllister calling Cambridge Narrows, New Brunswick. We have some Australian Shepherd dogs around here, and we had a litter of pups, and I was watering them one night. And I bent over to pick their watering pail, which was full of ice-cold, nice, fresh country water, up off the floor. And as I did, the cell phone fell out of my shirt pocket into the drink. And I panicked. I first watered the puppies, then I dried the phone off of whatever I had around my neck, and got it into the house and put the hairdryer to it, and then I stuck it in the oven. And I would recommend a wet cell phone at 350 for about 20 minutes and to let the oven cool down au naturel so the phone cools with it, and a big cell phone has been working ever since.
A couple of weeks back on Spark, we met Ivan Bowman. He's the guy who works from his home in Halifax, but has a robot version of himself that roams around the office with his colleagues in Waterloo, Ontario. We had a great yap about it on the Spark blog. Ivan, the robot guy, moderated the discussion and answered questions from the Spark community.
Hi, Ivan. My name is Doug Kay, and I'm just moved from Calgary to Halifax, and I'm working remotely for a company back there. How do you handle doors or elevators, or is this a non-issue for your robot?
Hi, Douglas. Doors are not a huge issue because the layout of our building is pretty open. The people that I most often need to talk to are all on the third floor, and I can get to their office without going through doorways. On a few occasions, we've even moved the robot to another floor for a general meeting or for a social event in the cafeteria. But on a couple of occasions, I have asked someone to open the door for me. Bye.
Now, on the next Spark... No, they're not wind chimes. That is the sound of Wi-Fi, what emails sound like when they're converted into audio at the hands of an artist. Visit the Spark blog to hear more and post your comments. cbc.ca/spark. Okay, back to the life of the product. So it's been designed, you've researched it, you bought it, it's sitting in your hand. What if you have a question about how to use it or something isn't working right? Does this sound familiar?
Sorry, I didn't get that. Just tell me what you're calling about, and I'll help you with your request. Here are some of the things you can say. Billing, moving...
It's not any of those things. It's my phone, my cell phone.
Okay, your phone. Could you tell me more specifically what you're calling about?
Satisfaction is a website that takes the old model, where the consumer just sits and takes whatever answer the company decides to provide, and turns it on its head. It's called crowdsourcing. Customers themselves actually contribute information. The answer to questions about how to care for the product or what to do if something goes wrong, say, that kind of thing. Lane Becker is one of the people behind Satisfaction. The idea all started when Lane's friends started a small company.
Not even a company, really, sort of a small e-commerce project. And it took off like wildfire, mostly through weblogs, actually through blogs and word-of-mouth marketing. So it was really exciting for them. It was really unexpected. And part of what was unexpected about it was that they got a deluge of customer service email. People had questions. They had concerns. They were spending money. And so my friends, they were just overwhelmed. At the same time, they had originally gotten all that word of mouth because of a weblog post that they'd done that had gotten a lot of attention, a lot of links to it. In the comments section, they actually ended up seeing a lot of the same questions coming up. But in that section of the blog, the answers, the same answers came up, but most of the time those answers came from other customers.
So the light bulb went off. And how does Satisfaction actually work for anyone who hasn't seen the site?
Well, it's pretty straightforward, actually. It's a discussion system. So it's basically a way for you to talk to your customers and for your customers to talk to each other, but all in one place. And basically the way it works is, you know, anyone can come in, they can post a question, or they can post a problem that they're having, or they can post an idea that they want to share, either with other customers or with the company. And from there, anyone else who is interested or in some way tied to that company can see those questions, can respond to them, and can interact with them.
And what kinds of products and services are listed at Satisfaction?
You know, Apple and all of the Macintosh and iPod products get a ton of discussion. But we're also seeing a lot of sort of smaller retailers. There's a bag manufacturer here in San Francisco.
I'm Patty Roll. I work here at Timbuktu.
Timbuktu makes messenger bags.
Computer bags and totes and all kinds of things.
And they've gotten pretty heavily involved in the system and have actually seen a drop in the amount of email that they get as a result.
Been up and running on Get Satisfaction now for about 2.5 weeks. One of the things that I've noticed is that customers post a question, and real customers, not us and not Get Satisfaction, but other real customers start to answer those questions.
So I can see that it would save small businesses a fair bit of time answering individual emails, but are there other advantages of using crowdsourcing over more traditional ways of providing customer service?
Oh, absolutely. Companies that we have on the site have started using it for all sorts of interesting things. They've started using it for market research and customer feedback on what kinds of products to make next. They started using it to identify sort of their strongest word-of-mouth evangelists and having, you know, private conversations with them so that they can start figuring out how to really sort of use them or to work with them to best effect for both the company and the customer.
But is there a risk involved for the point of view of the businesses in that, what if, you know, your customers start saying, this thing was a piece of crap, it didn't work properly, you know? I mean, you have to be a little bit more open, I guess, in terms of not needing to control your message so much.
That is absolutely the trade-off the companies have to make. But I think ultimately it's one that's really valuable for them. Because quite honestly, you know, that conversation has always been going on. If your product sucks, someone has been saying it sucks.
Just behind your back.
That's right. And this actually gives you an opportunity to jump in and engage in that conversation. If people care about your product and you release a version that's not very good, you know, there is going to be 100 blogs that spring up to tell you that.
Marketing as it used to be is over. What happens now on comment streams, that has changed. The web has changed the access that consumers have to other consumers, and that's huge. It should be part of your own website, because having a customer say, I love this bag, or I wish you guys would change this, holds so much more value to other consumers than the voice of the company, quote unquote.
I mean, I find it a really fascinating phenomenon, but, you know, Lane, like, what's in it for me? Why would I want to give up my own personal time to contribute to this kind of conversation?
I'd say that one of the things that we've really learned from the web over the last 10 years is that we've traditionally thought of payment systems as, well, payment, you know, as systems of reward, as, you know, I give you something and you give me money.
Right.
But now we see all sorts of different economies coming up. There's, you know, the reputation economy. There's the gift economy. And I think, you know, something like the reputation economy, it's all about, I'm going to do this because I want to establish myself as, you know, as someone who's an expert in this field or an expert with this product. You know, this means a lot to me, whether it's, you know, I mean, you can make fun of this, I suppose, but for a lot of people, their consumer electronics mean a lot to them. Mm-hmm. I'm a diehard Apple fan, a complete Mac head, and the idea that I could somehow affect the direction that the Macintosh is going or that the iPod is going is really interesting and engaging to me. And if it's that for me, then, you know, for someone else, it's the, you know, the baby products that they use and love every day, or it's the cleaning products, or it's that messenger bag from Timbuktu. I think it's just about the products that we identify with, the things that matter to us, and really being able to engage and have some impact on those things.
Thanks a lot, Lane.
Oh, absolutely. Thanks for having me.
You can find a link to Satisfaction at our blog, cbc.ca/spark. The thing I think is really cool about Satisfaction is that it's linked to a broader social trend, pro-am culture. It's the idea of blurring professional and amateur, where a core of passionate hobbyists design, contribute, and develop new goods and services, often collaborating with professionals, because, like Lane says, that creative energy is part of their self-identity. When it comes to product life, one reason we love getting new gadgets is that we're addicted to their pristine, shiny look. I mean, think of the heartbreak the first time you get a scratch on your shiny new MP3 player, or when you step out into a shopping mall parking lot and there's a mark on your new car. Coy Vinh knows a thing or two about design. He's the design director at NewYorkTimes.com. And we were very intrigued by a post he wrote at his blog about electronics and wear and tear.
I have a $20 cast iron skillet that I bought several years ago from a restaurant supply shop in downtown Manhattan. I've cooked hundreds of meals with it, and over time it has developed a coating from oil and food. The manufacturers call it seasoning. It's a little unbecoming when you think about it. In fact, though I clean it, it's a dirty piece of cookware, and it resembles its original store-bought state not at all. But it's also a beautiful piece of design. After cooking in it and cleaning it up, I spent a lot of time just looking it over, marveling at how its very deterioration has been incorporated into the design of the object, and how it's gotten more attractive, less ignorant, the more I use it. I'm not particularly sentimental about much in my kitchen, but I would be heartbroken if you took away this iron skillet.
So, Coy, your skillet gets better with age, but your electronic devices, things like iPods and so on, don't. And you'd like it instead if electronics had what you're calling designed deterioration. What is that?
It's just my idea that you can actually plan for a product to get more beautiful as it ages. And that's just something I've noticed that is not done today because of planned obsolescence. And it's the term I came up with to describe that phenomenon.
So how would design deterioration actually play out in the way electronics look?
Well, it might mean it returned to more basic materials. Like, we never see wood in electronic devices anymore, partly because it's so expensive. Or it might be designing an object with metal the way the back of an iPod is and trying to promote it as an object that actually is going to get some scuffs and some scratches and actually get more attractive over time.
I'm thinking of the way a fountain pen, when you use a fountain pen, the nib kind of adjusts to whatever your personal stroke is. But when you're using a technological object, you know, like an iPod or whatever, the functioning is all internal. It's not really affected by
software.
The world around it. Yeah,
I think that's definitely part of it. A lot of those older objects are very mechanical. They have parts that are meant to move, whereas with an iPod, I mean, the most that the object actually functions or pivots is the click wheel that you have on it. So I think that is part of it.
Mm-hmm.
But really, if you think about it, there's no inherent reason you can't use an iPod or an MP3 player for decades, and there's no reason that object can't sort of acquire the same kind of personality that these older mechanical objects have. The objects we purchase from purveyors of digital technology are conceived only up to the point of sale. The inevitable nicks, scratches, weathering, and fading they will encounter is not factored in at all. The result is that as they see more use, their ignorance may recede, but they wear it poorly. They don't age gracefully.
You refer to this idea of objects being ignorant in some way.
Right.
Can you explain that?
Yeah, that's a quote I heard Jasper Johns when he was putting together an art piece with a broom, and I think he actually bought a used broom from somebody from like a superintendent somewhere because he wanted a broom that he said was that had some knowledge. He did not want an ignorant broom. He wanted something that had been used and there had been some experience invested in it. And I thought that's a really sort of poetic way of describing objects that have aged with use. They've acquired knowledge of the world. They're no longer sort of these pristine, sort of ignorant kinds of vessels for experience. They wear it poorly. They don't age gracefully. That's just not right. An object should be designed not just for sale, but also for day-to-day wear and tear. With use, this iPhone should get more attractive, should become like a trusted and inseparable friend.
If we take manufacturers' desire just to sell more and more new gadgets just out of the equation and we look at it just from a design point of view, does that mean that all design should be made to age like a fine wine?
I think that it's perfectly fine to design for the moment. I think it's perfectly fine to create something that reflects today's values and that you don't always have to design under the burden of creating something timeless. I actually don't think that our craft and our art manages to make progress if you're always trying to design something timeless.
Right. Coy, thanks very much for joining us.
Sure, thanks for having me.
Koivin is the design director for NewYorkTimes.com, and he writes the blog Subtraction. Whether it's trash luxe design, crowdsourcing your customer service, or Koi's design to deterioration, some trend watchers think we're seeing a burbling reaction to mindless passive consumption. It's a reclaiming of the history and meaning of the things around us. Now, that wet cell phone certainly had a history. Now, we did try actually putting a wet cell phone in dry rice for real to see if it would work. We used an old phone of our colleague Nicola's. We took the battery out immediately. That is important. You have to take the battery out immediately. And we left it in the dry rice for 24 hours. Will it turn on? Well, here it is. You have to be kind of careful because the rice tends to get a bit sort of lodged in. And there's the battery, lithium ion battery. Get the rice out. Okay, now, moment of truth time here. And I'm holding down the button to start it. It turned on! Yay! Well, I wouldn't recommend dropping your phone in the water, but the cell phone in the rice, it seems to have worked for us. We also asked an expert about what to do if your cell phone gets wet and you can't get to a repair outlet or you don't like rice. And we've got a step-by-step walkthrough at our blog. You can hear the interview at cbc.ca/spark. And that's it for Spark this time around. The show was made by Dan Meisner, Elizabeth Bowie, Tom Howell, and me, Nora Young, and by
Karen Ryan,
Michael Kiefrel,
Kevin.
My name's Lane Becker.
Corey Venn.
And the Spark community, Jenna,
Sandy McAllister,
Judith,
Corey Maskant,
Douglas Kay,
Ivan Bowman. The show was made with Creative Commons music. Find the artists at the blog cbc.ca/spark, where you can catch sneak previews of the show, hear the whole show again, or join the conversation with me online. Talk to you next time. Hi, I'm Nora Young, the host of Spark on CBC Radio. What is Spark, you ask? Well, Spark is...
Spark is online.
Spark is interactive.
Spark is a conversation.
Spark is digital.
Spark is a new kind of radio show.
You can check out the Spark blog, contribute to the show, and download the podcast at cbc.ca/spark.